Hi, everyone. Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Ear to the Podium, listening for what's next in music education. I'm so excited to be hosting one of my favorite composers this week by the name of Miss Alex Shapiro. Miss Shapiro hails from San Juan Island in Washington State, off the coast of Seattle, and is known for her electroacoustic and acoustic music, her innovative approaches to composition, and her fun approach to music education and the auditory palette that she blesses us with in each of her creations. Ms. Shapiro was a student of Ursula Mamluk and John Carigliano at the Juilliard School and the Manhattan School of Music, and we are so excited for her to be sharing her wealth of wisdom and information with us today. I hope you enjoy our conversation with Alex Shapiro on the effects of COVID-19 from a composer's standpoint, and what lessons we should take with us in the music education world as we come out of the COVID-19 pandemic. Enjoy. Thank you, Alex Shapiro, for being with us today, composer extraordinaire. We are so excited to have your perspective on music education and your experiences, especially in the last couple of years. We're talking today about how COVID-19 and that experience has affected music education from a composer's viewpoint. We've heard a lot from music educators along the way, but you know, the people that are actually writing music for us and our traditional music experiences, the pandemic has asked for so much new repertoire for you and faced a lot of new challenges in how we make music and how we can even safely make music. So let's just start with what were your first thoughts when this all went down and you started hearing that schools were closing and all of the band directors started going or started saying, we can't do music. What crossed your mind as someone who makes a living writing for teachers who are used to making music in an ensemble and in a social setting?
The first thing that crossed my mind is, of course, we can still make music. We have to change our expectations and ideas about how we can make music and how we can do it really well and in a meaningful way. So for me, there's never a roadblock with anything. It's always a matter of, okay, here's a challenge. We weren't expecting this one, were we? And okay, so what's the solution? There's always got to be a solution as far as I'm concerned. And so I went right to work thinking on a lot of different levels and getting involved in a lot of different things that would, I hoped, you know, help add to the positives that were that we needed at a very difficult time and continue to need as we go into year three shortly of this. I mean, it's just sort of endless, isn't it? And yeah. So it has forced all of us to think creatively, which is that in and of itself is not a bad thing. I mean, how many times do we all think, you know, live your life as creatively as you would write your music and think as creatively about everything as you would think if you're a composer about creatively solving a problem within a piece. So it's the same idea. Bring your creativity A game to the fore and think, you know, very much as they say, outside of the box and figure it out. So a lot of people, I think, have figured it out really beautifully. And that's been incredibly inspiring to see.
For sure. Talk to me about the creative process that your brain went through. So were you already working on a project that you were able to start adapting? Or did your brain just go, okay, so now we have this situation. How are we getting past this? What was the journey that creative process took from there?
It was both, because I had a bunch of commissions that I was currently doing. I checked in, interestingly, this is very interesting. I checked in with my commissioners and asked them, I said, you know, kind of midway through some of the pieces I was about to start, some of them I was kind of in the middle of. And I said, do you need me to do this, approach this differently? Should it be for varying personnel? Should it be adaptable and flex? And I'm sure you and I will talk about all of that. Should it be, you know, asking questions. And happily, frankly, everybody said, no, just, you know, write for the repertoire, write what you were going to write. And I think part of that is because we were all assuming we'd be done with this craziness a lot sooner. But for me, I have to say, artistically, it was fantastic to get that response. Not that I am not all for writing flexible pieces. And again, we'll talk about that, because I certainly did write several flex and adaptable pieces. But artistically, you're going to have the most to say and the most freedom when you can have everything at your disposal, as you normally would, especially for more sophisticated pieces. One of the pieces that I was in the midst of doing or about to start, I can't remember at what point I was at, was my second symphony called Suspended, which did amazingly end up getting its premiere in July of last year, July of 2021, at the National Inter, the Intercollegiate Band, National Intercollegiate Band in Grand Rapids, under the fantastic baton of Dr. Cynthia Johnston Turner, who is incredible. And I, you know, I think it was up for grabs whether that was even going to get to premiere. And for me, it was a major work. It's a four-movement work. That is not an insignificant piece. So happily, that went on, and it was scored for exactly what I would score it for, you know, regardless. But other pieces, at the same time that I was finishing up commissions, I was also adding some things to my own docket to be able to contribute to the needs of what I thought educators and band directors might be needing in the coming months. And as you know, there was a terrific initiative. The Creative Repertoire Initiative was formed with a bunch of composers, many of whom are probably best known or very well known in the band world, but we all write other things as well, of course. And it was the brainchild of two band directors, Robert Ambrose and Alan McMurray, and I believe Frank Tichelli. I think the three of them kind of kicked it off when they were talking, and then invited a whole bunch of other composers to, you know, jump on board. And we all did. And that was very fulfilling. That would have been about April or so of 2020, April or May. And we jumped right in and decided, okay, we got to do two things. We got to, all of us, step up. And let's add some music to the repertoire that will be playable no matter who shows up, you know, in the band room, if anybody, or could be done at home, you know, via recordings, et cetera. And then additionally, as again, I know you know, is we started a big Facebook group, which now has 5,600 members of band directors and composers. And our goal was to get all other composers, as many as we could imagine, writing flexible and adaptable music. That was our goal, is to get everybody contributing to the repertoire. And it worked great. I mean, I think that it's just taken off. And people also now realize that regardless of pandemics, let's hope that we don't have to deal with this too much longer and never again, but in general, in life, you need this kind of music, because there are all kinds of reasons that you want a piece to be able to be played by any variety of musicians for any number of circumstances. One of them is community bands. I just did a really fun conversation with Keith Kelly and Gail Breckning and Caitlin Bove about just this, about the community band needs for flexibility and adaptability. So it's a win-win all the way around. So I did some of that stuff too. And then finally, I was really lucky, Cameron, because I backed into a fortunate situation where, because the majority of my band catalog is electroacoustic, what that means is the easier pieces in particular, the ones that are more grade three, grade four, lent themselves really well for students being able to play along at home and record their, you know, tracks and their parts at home. And then for some very intrepid engineer, putting all of these tracks together, as became the norm with all these virtual performances, when everybody just wanted to make sure that they could still make music in some way as a group, because they knew they couldn't do it live, because we don't have the internet speed for that yet. But I was very lucky for that too, that it just turned out that many pieces of my catalog were really well suited to this. So it was a very creative time, thinking on a lot of different levels at once, and also trying to provide a lot of information. Since I am pretty techie, and a lot of people know that, I wanted to help provide information to the educators about technology and methods and things that they could do that would help them in their situations. So with that, Mark Speed and many other really amazing band directors formed the COVID-19 response committee from CBDNA. And I was the composer on that one too, kind of cheerleading along and saying, you know, yeah, let's figure this out and come up with a paper of suggestions. So, yeah.
I remember when the creative initiative kind of came about with Alan McMurray and all of them. And I was personally so excited to see you on that list because I couldn't think of anyone better off the top of my head, because
thanks.
Knowing your repertoire as I do, and having performed it with my students myself, you know, I know that the electroacoustic side of things has been a passion and a voice of yours in your repertoire for a long time. Mm-hmm. So how did you find a new compositional style in that by creating a even more electroacoustic, or saying, or creating the moments where maybe if you're on a Zoom meeting for say with your symphonic band, you know, having that electroacoustic track, but not everyone's having to respond at the same time because of delays. How did it change your compositional approach or evolve it from the electroacoustic traditions that you were already familiar with to some of the pieces that came out during that time? If I remember correctly, Passages was one of them.
That's right, Passages, which is a very different piece for me. Yep. And the one constant is that I felt that the quality of the track, production values, wealth of sonic information, you know, in the track remained very important, and more so than ever in a sense, because it's going to be in a student's earbuds over and over and over and over again as they're laying down their part, right? If they're recording at home. So Passages was different for me in a few ways. Stylistically, I did take a different tack than I normally do, and it was one of almost new age music. It's very calming. It's repetitive and calming, and I did that intentionally because everything around us was swirling in uncertainty and chaos and stress. And I felt like if I'm going to have students playing a piece of music, and especially hearing a track over and over and over again as they're playing it, I'd like to chill them out and not stress them out. So I went with something that was pretty soothing. And then the other reason I did a track like that, that was this more simple in its chord progressions, is because I wanted to give agency and control to students that were feeling neither of those things by giving them all these cells, all these little snippets of, you know, 4-bar lines that they can mix and match, play any of them in any order or not. You know, they could play any of them. The only rule is start at the beginning of one before you go to the next. But it was a whole smorgasbord of little musical ideas. And the key thing is all of them sound good against each other and against the track, no matter which are played at the same time over which chord in the track. That was like doing a puzzle. I have to say, working that one out was a challenge for me. I'd never done anything like that before, but it occurred to me it would be fun. And if it worked, it might tank totally. It might have been a disaster. And the only way to find out if something's going to be a disaster is give it a try, right? It's not brain surgery. You can take the risk without anybody dying. So I did that. And those were two differences, at least, in how I was working creatively and what I was thinking about and focusing on, unlike when I just normally sit down to write a good piece of music, which is going to, you know, not have those considerations, you know, in it at the start.
What feedback were you getting from students and composers during this time regarding the new pieces that you were writing, regarding these, experiential approaches to the composition? Do you feel that students and educators were still feeling like they were getting an educational experience and a spiritual and a musical experience out of these pieces and out of this movement, even though we weren't all in the same room making music together like we had in the past?
Yeah, I mean, my feedback was really positive. You know, I think I learned don't make it so complicated to line people up. I figured out a few tricks along the way to make it easier for synchronization, but that's just a technical thing that what we keep learning. Those of us who do EA music are continually trying to figure out how to make it as easy as possible for everybody. But that aside, you know, that doesn't have to do with the music. But I think anything, and this really depends on the way the educator themselves thinks. If an educator is enthusiastic and creative themselves and puts something forward in a really great way, you know, to their students, it's going to be a very positive experience for the students, that they are going to get something marvelously educational and spiritual and musical and of worth artistically, all those things. They're going to get that out of it. I really think it has to do with what you put into it and what your mindset is, both yours as the educator and the students, you know, as the players. So, and, you know, I keep saying educator, and of course my music is played by a lot of educational institutions and done by a lot of educators. But one of the things I've been saying a lot recently, because I've been thinking a lot about it, is I never ever write educational music, you know, and I don't think any composer should sit down to write educational music. I think they should sit down to write the best music they can. And also, as they're writing, as I do, and I'll give you an example in a second, as they come across things that would be really cool for the ensemble director to point out to the students, make a note of it as you're going, because when you're done with the piece, you won't remember all the things you were thinking of while you were crafting it. But you make a note of these things. And so you're helping the educator make it a better educational experience. But with luck, the music itself is so worthwhile artistically that's the reason to do it, is to connect with people's hearts, to give them a very fine musical experience. I don't think of anything as being educational. If anything, unfortunately, that term stupidly has a stigma, right? It's like, oh, if it's educational music, it's probably not, you know, very compelling or very good. And frankly, there's a historic reason for that, because a lot of music in the past that was written as educational music is pretty damn boring, right? not all of it, of course, but there's a fair amount of, you know, pablum out there. And so our jobs as living composers who have every style and every approach at our disposal is to, you know, roll up our sleeves and just put our best artistic effort forward, and then give directors and educators a path through all of that good art that also helps them, you know, turn it into an educational thing. And the thing I was going to point to is I'm writing a piece right now that happens to be, it's a very funny piece. I hope it's funny. It's comedic. And we'll find out, won't we? Comedy is subjective. But it happens to be a 12-tone row that it's based on. This is the third piece of mine for a wind ensemble that I've done with a serial 12-tone row. And great fun. They're all really different. One of them is Tight Squeeze, which a lot of people know. Wow. And that's a very up-tempo bop, you know, groove piece. This one isn't a groove piece per se, but it's definitely in a different pocket, but it's pretty funny. Anyway, what I've been doing, because I'm having a good time with it, playing around with not only the row, but also the motivic development or the sections, you know, when do the sections come back and where do they come back? The kinds of things you want to teach students, right? Show them form and development in any given piece. I've been making notes as I go through, and back here, you know, on my screens here, where are called markers, you know, sections of pieces, et cetera. I just make the notes, A theme return, you know, the fourth time or whatever, B theme, C section, this, that, you know, I've been keeping those notes going. And then what I do, and I did this with, I think I did this with my piece Breathe. I think I did it with Tight Squeeze. But I basically like to be able to have a one sheet to include on the download page for the educators who are also wonderful musicians, to say, hey, if you want to talk about how this piece was structured, you know, it becomes a composition lesson and a form and development and theory lesson. For me, it's never theory in terms of chord progressions and all that, because I just don't think that way. And my music is too bitonal and weird often harmonically, you know, to really do a good analysis on like that. It's not meant to be analyzed in that way. But form-wise, it's really tight. A lot of my stuff is really tight form-wise. So there's a great example of hopefully my best music as a musical experience, but something that is going to give a good educational portal to the students.
Absolutely. What do you wish that musicians would learn from the COVID-19 experience that we're all going through right now?
To be positive no matter what, and to find joy and beauty and possibility in everything, that it's up to them. Instead of getting those, and this is a good life lesson in general, instead of getting our fulfillment from external sources, find ways to get it from yourself, from internal sources. That's where you will always be safe and in control and happy. And whether it's music or anything else, I'm not saying that we shouldn't, of course, fill our lives with external things, but I'm saying that I think those who have an ability to look inward and find and create and discover and explore from the inward out, instead of needing stimulus from the outside, I think that those people do the best in terms of flexibility in life and positive things that they can create and make happen in their lives, regardless of any challenges. So that's something I think I'd like students to be aware of, that they have more power than they may think.
Absolutely. Agency is a beautiful thing, you know, as musicians. And finally, what is your wish and your hope for the future of music education as a whole?
I'm hoping that, and we're already seeing, you know, NAFME standards and others heading in this direction, that there won't be such an artificial divide between playing music, you know, recreating it, and creating music. That there is no reason why every person who picks up an instrument can't also write music. If you can play music, you can write music. You know, it's like if you can speak English, you can write it. Or any language, right? It shouldn't be like, oh, I only speak it. I have no idea how to write down my sentences. You know, it shouldn't be like that. You know, a language isn't like that. And ideas aren't like that. You know, you come up with general ideas. You could come up with, if you ask a kid, come up with a storyline, most kids can come up with a story, like no matter how basic, a story, right? It should not be any different with music. And my crusade is to make sure that especially younger people going into it, never hear the word no, never hear discouragement about their own possibilities for being creative, that it's not just about playing music, it's about making music and writing music and improvising and being free with your expression. And again, this is all great, guess what, for mental health. It's great for them as human beings, you know, whether they become musicians or not. This is what I hope is bring down those artificial barriers, telling students that they can't do this or they're not good enough for that, or they're only an oboist and not a composer. You know, that's ridiculous. Everybody can compose.
Excellent. Alex, thank you so much for joining us today. Your insights have been so beautiful and so inspiring to listen to. I hope all of our listeners will get something new out of this conversation and be inspired to go back into their own classrooms and see these own very natural musical experiences with a fresh set of eyes that allows them to appreciate every bit of musical talent and experience that their students bring to the room.
Thank you so much, Cameron. I think it's really great you wanted to have this conversation. You're awesome. Thank you. And no doubt I will see you online.
We'll talk soon.
Okay. Take good care. Bye. Right.
Thank you so much for listening to Ear to the Podium, listening for what's next in music education. I'm your host, Cameron Elliott, and I look forward to having you with us for our next episode coming very soon.